What up? Welcome back to episode 3 of the still unnamed Blazers Edge Kevin Pelton podcast. KP2, how are you doing this morning?
I'm doing well.
So, you know, it's been like 3 weeks now. We still don't have a name. And, you know, we should probably let people in on the fact that we've been struggling to come up with a name for, what, about 4 or 5 days now. So far, the leading entrance that we came up with, well, I think the best, by far the best, was D'Antonio Wingcast. And that was sort of like based on the fact that D'Antonio Wingfield had played for the Sonics and the Blazers, so we could each kind of feel a personal involvement to him. But then we did a little bit of Wikipedia research, and turns out he, like, you know, was arrested for killing cops, and he was part of 9/11. He's hiding out in Afghanistan right now. So we couldn't go with that. Then the second one we came up with, this is actually my personal favorite, but you hate it, and it was 77-79, playing off of, you know, the years that our respective franchises won the NBA title. But what'd you compare it to again?
I thought that it sounded like the title of some sort of 1980s concept album.
It's like Prince, you know. But I thought that had promise. 77-79, it kind of runs off the tongue. And we could, like, alternate spelling the number out with the actual number and get real, you know, artistic with our graphics for it. All right. You didn't like that one, though, so you shot up and down. Those were our top two. What else did we come up with? Something to do with I-5 rivalry, you know. And then I think at one point you had mentioned you wanted to call it Dyke Access Road for your favorite rest stop along the Seattle to Portland freeway, and I had to shoot that one down because we didn't want to get typecast on iTunes as being some sort of a perverted podcast. So really, we're still struggling. So we're going to take your advice and ask all the readers to come up with the name for our podcast, so that we don't have to call it the Blazers Edge KP2 podcast every time we refer to it, correct?
Yeah, I mean, we're obviously not creative enough to come up with a name for this podcast, so I think that's why we got to turn to the readers now.
We can't be messing around with this small talk, KP2. We have a lot going on. First of all, obviously, we have a special guest for the first time ever. That'd be Clyde Drexler. And that's going to come up at the very end of the podcast. So if you guys are just sick of us, just fast forward to, like, what, the 35 or 40-minute mark, you'll get to Clyde. But before we get to that, obviously, we have a lot to talk about, even though it's the middle of the summer and there's nothing going on. And our first topic that we decided on was unemployed NBA players and who's still out there that could make a difference in the league, who's still out there that may be entering forced retirement. I understand that you've got a list of your top, as yet unemployed NBA players. But really the crux of the issue that's causing this problem for the NBA players is the fact that teams are shortening their rosters, right? So teams generally in the past have kept 14 or 15 players. This year we're seeing a trend where teams are pulling that back and maybe 13 or 14 players. So what ends up disappearing is, you know, between, say, 20 and 60 jobs, you know, over the entire 30 teams in the NBA are being retracted. So it's a pretty good chunk, pretty good portion of professional basketball players that were thinking they were going to get NBA dollars that are now probably looking for other avenues. So in terms of the Blazers, that might have been affected. Obviously, Shavik Randolph still has not signed on with the team. Sources close to the player inform me that he's got a couple teams interested right now, but I can't divulge any more than that. Obviously, that would probably, you know, spark a Mike Vick-like headline on ESPN, so we got to be careful there. And also, obviously, Michael Ruffin was on the Blazers roster last year, and he probably won't have a job, and his career is probably over unless he wants to go the Europe route or something else. He's getting up there in age, so he may just, you know, retire to the life of luxury of Christian rock concerts and minivans, which seems to be treating him pretty well. So those are the Blazers affected, but I want to get your thoughts first on the retraction. You know, obviously, economy prompted it, and then also maybe some of the guys who are still out there that you think could add value either to a team like the Blazers or another team that's really looking for a championship next year.
Let me start, as I usually do, Ben, with giving you some numbers. So the last week or so, I've been working on projecting the 2009-2010 season using our Shaney projection tool that we have at Basketball Prospectus. So this requires me to go through and project minutes for each team and come up with the rosters and rotations and that sort of thing. And in the process of doing it, it's really remarkable how many teams are saying, we're going with 13 players, or it's August, what is it, the 14th today, and our roster is set right now. We're not going to add anybody else. We're not going to bring anybody to training camp who's got to make the team. I mean, the financial concerns for a lot of these teams are very real. It's both kind of these, you know, some of the smaller teams that are not bringing in a lot of revenue and just don't want to spend money. And then also you've got teams that are over the luxury tax line, and each of these contracts are going to be counting double. I mean, I think a lot of the moves that we're going to see in the NBA between now and the start of training camp are really going to be driven by financial issues. Rasul Butler getting traded to the Clippers the other day was a great example of that. He was a starter at the Hornets for shooting guard last year, played 32 minutes a night, but, you know, they were able to save $8 million by trading him, and they have a bunch of other options there, so it made a lot of sense for them. Yesterday, Quentin Richardson getting traded for either the fourth or like the 40th time this offseason, going from Minnesota to Miami, so that Minnesota can save like $1.5 million next year with Mark Blunt's contract. So, I mean, that's what we're seeing, and there's just not a lot of money out there for the free agents. By my math, there's somewhere around a little over 380 players signed for next season, two deals, somewhere in the range of 380 to 390. If you had 14 players per team, that would be 420 spots. So we're talking maybe, and that's kind of optimistic, maybe about 30 more guys getting signed. And there's a group of about 50 players who played in the NBA last season, played at least a decent number of minutes, and are guys who would legitimately expect to be back in the league next year. But there's just not going to be spots for all those guys. And like you mentioned, Ruffin is one of them. I'm not sure if he was going to be with the team either way. I think Shavlik is one of those guys who's really going to get hurt because of the fact that he was a borderline case. If you were keeping a 14th or a 15th guy, he's a pretty good option there. But if you're only keeping 13, then all of a sudden you don't have that room for him.
Now, what role has Europe been playing here? Because we have seen, especially in the past week or so, a bunch of guys sort of pull themselves out of that number crunch and just say, hey, you know what? Olympiacos is offering me more money than any NBA team would. I'd rather be, a starter over there or, maybe first guy off the bench or what have you in Europe and get paid well and compensated well for it while there's still money out there than worry about being, on the deep bench of a team in the NBA. So has that crop kind of dwindled in part because guys like Vaughn Wafer and Linus Klaser have decided, hey, you know what, it's not even worth it to try to get the scraps that are still available. I'm just going to go get a real contract somewhere else.
See, I feel like the Olympiacos thing kind of gives people a bad impression about what it's like all over Europe. And last year especially, we saw the money flowing a lot of Russia with guys like Nenad Krstic. I believe Gennaro Pargo initially signed in Russia, even though he ended up, I think, playing possibly for Olympiacos or in Greece somewhere by the end of the year. And Russia has dried up a lot financially. I mean, this economic crisis has hit the entire world and has hit parts of Europe even more than it has hit the U.S. So, Vaughn Wafer and Linus Klaser got really good money from Olympiacos, and it ended up being very much worth their while. They got more than I think either of those guys would have gotten here in the U.S., and certainly in Vaughn Wafer's case, probably about double. I think he got about $5 million from Olympiacos for next year, and there wasn't that much interest in his services. But that money has kind of dried up, too. I mean, there's only so many spots for non-Europeans on the rosters, so I think Olympiacos is about done. They still have Josh Childress on their roster. And, I started to read about spots in Europe becoming scarce as well. So there was a story about a player who played ball in Jazz and their summer league deciding to go over and play in Finland, I think it was, because he didn't feel like he would have a chance to make the Jazz's roster. It probably would have required Matt Harpering to retire, and he just wasn't willing to take that, and he needed to take the guarantee of the European money while it was still out there. So there's going to be competition even for that, I think, going forward.
Absolutely, and it really gets to be even another squeeze, right? So you have a guy like Shavlik, basically his options are, stay here, hope and wait, keep the feelers out there with all the NBA teams, hope he can grab one of those, say, 13 roster spots per team, as we get real close to training camp. Or his other option is bail to Europe, which is, as we just talked about, sort of a decreasingly, you know, likely thing for a lot of those guys to do. I mean, are they almost at the point where they should just stay in shape, wait it out, and just play the injury game and see if they can get a 10-day contract? Or what do you recommend to guys like that who,
I guess that's where the D-League comes into play. You know, that's basically your opportunity to stay in front of NBA scouts. You get a chance to play in the U.S., which is, you know, better for a lot of these guys than having to go overseas and adjust to a different language and different culture and things like that. And you're available at any time for an NBA call-up. And you know, as much as we throw out that number of 400 or 420 or whatever the number of guys ultimately will be on opening day rosters, there's a lot more players than that that end up playing in the league over the course of the year because there's so much turnover and 10-day contracts and things like that. So, I don't want to rule out guys like that playing in the league, but in the short term, the fact is the D-League is a worse alternative than Europe because of the fact that they just make so little money there, and you know the travel is not what guys who have been in the NBA are used to, things like that. So it's going to be a bitter pill to swallow a little bit, but with the chance of working out in the end. And I think, you know, my expectations that this is probably a short-term thing, and that next year we'll see rosters start to fill out a little bit more as teams start to do better financially.
Hey, so let's get some of these names that are still out there available that could help contenders. I don't really care about the guys that might end up, you know, having the highest percentage chance of sticking on bad teams. I'm more interested at who's out there that could help, you know, teams that do seem to be going for it this year. I mean, I think we can agree that it's kind of stratified, and you've got teams, I think Portland's in that group, that are really going for pushing for the championship or pushing for contention next year. And you've got a lot of teams who are kind of punting on this season and looking to the future, rebuilding, cutting costs, that type of thing. Who's out there right now that could help some contenders?
It's kind of a weird situation. I don't know that there's a lot of guys left in that kind of boat that you've been talking. You're talking about a guy, about veterans who can come in and play a role in a contending team. Joe Smith is maybe a guy like that who is, I don't know if he'll even sign with the team at the start of the season or if he wants to go on a plan where he just joins the team in February and comes in and fills a role for them for the playoffs. You know, that's what he did effectively for Cleveland the last couple of years, coming over in first a midseason trade and then after the Thunder bought him out last year. But his spot on the roster has been taken by Leon Poe, who is probably the last guy really that caliber who I think will make a real difference in the Eastern Conference. And I think the addition of Leon Poe is enough, in my opinion, for the Cavaliers to become the favorites in the East right now. But most of the guys you've got left on the market are in a slightly different situation. It's all these restricted free agents for whom there isn't a lot of money beyond the mid-level exception, and teams might not be willing to make the offer sheet thinking that their old team is going to match. Their old teams don't necessarily want to commit money because of salary cap flexibility. So you've got my number one guy left on the board is David Lee, you know, who I thought was probably 1A amongst free agents overall between him and Paul Millsap. But New York is exactly what we're talking about in terms of they don't want to commit money for 2010 right now. It may be a case where he has to go back to the Knicks on a qualifying offer. Then you've got Ramon Sessions. We've heard a lot about the Clippers, maybe even the Knicks spending some of that money for the long term, believing that he could be a key player for them. And I'm pretty convinced that Ramon Sessions is going to be, at the very least, a very good point guard in this league and maybe even a star point guard. So it's remarkable that he's still sort of sitting out there as this bargain. Then Nate Robinson would be the third guy in that group, but again, another Knick. And beyond that, you're talking Raymond Felton with Charlotte. Who knows what's going to happen with him? They have DJ Augustine presumably taking over the starting point guard role last year and was already playing a lot of minutes there, playing at times alongside Felton in the backcourt last year. So who knows what's going to happen? Another team that's in money-saving mode. And, you know, you get much further beyond that. I mean, Allen Iverson is probably the most interesting free agent on the market in terms of where he's going to land and what he might bring to a team. And then we're getting down there a little bit. Bobby Jackson was a name that we heard here in Portland as far as potentially a third veteran point guard before the team decided to go the Andre Miller direction. James Singleton's probably headed back to Dallas, but he's a quality player off the bench. Steve Novak had a nice year for the Clippers last season, took advantage of all their injuries and showed that he is definitely a quality shooter and someone who can help the team with his ability to stretch the floor. I kind of like him for Denver as they're trying to replace Claxton in the lineup. So there's not a ton of guys there. The more interesting cases are probably, you know, the in the Shablik Randolph guys who have shown some things at the NBA level, have shown some promise, but not enough to say that they can definitely contribute to a team and help them out, especially a good team next year.
I love how you just completely avoided all the big names besides Iverson. That's why we go to UKP2. So a guy like Stackhouse, in your mind, he's done. He should just retire out to pasture.
Yeah, I can't see Stackhouse really helping a team a whole heck of a lot next year. I don't think he's not even on my list because he didn't play enough minutes last year to get a projection. But
okay, so Bowen, he's done.
I mean, there's a third guy and someone to come in situationally for like 5 minutes at a time. I think he could help a team, you know, especially someone that's kind of weak defensively on the wings. But you can't play him for regular minutes anymore. His offensive game has just deteriorated to the point where, you know, if San Antonio can't keep him on the floor, I don't know who can.
That's a good point. They can cover up a lot of flaws on that squad. All right, what about Ime Udoka?
Ime is one of those guys in a tough spot, you know. I mean, if you want the defensive specialist wing, you're probably looking at Bruce Bowen. And I think Ime might even, you know, with the fact that his game is more rounded, possibly bring you a little more value at this point in their respective careers. But there's a lot of guys like that on the market, and Devin Mason is another one who also is getting up there in years. So, you know, it's just a matter of what a team is looking for out of that spot, if they want someone a little younger or the more veteran presence, you know, if they want a leader in the locker room. And he's one of those guys who potentially could be on the bubble and for whom it might make sense to go over to Europe at this point.
Hey, what about Rashad McCants? He hasn't signed yet anywhere, has he?
He's not.
I feel like he might have the most raw talent and youth of any of these names. Is it just his attitude that's keeping him out, or what is the knock on him right now? He doesn't play any defense, I guess, but I can't believe that the Timberwolves would rather have Corey Brewer than Rashad McCants.
Yeah, attitude, defense. I mean, the Timberwolves tried the Rashad McCants thing, and then they decided it didn't work out. You know, he gave Sacramento some decent minutes at the end of last year after they made that trade for him at the trade deadline. And I could see, you know, a team that's not going anywhere giving him a chance. John Hollinger came up with a concept a few years ago called what he called the second draft, where it's these guys who come into the league really young and they don't work out with their first teams, but then they end up in free agency young enough that, you know, they've still got a chance to develop and become the player you originally thought they were going to be, but it's going to happen on their second team instead of their first. You know, Dallas tried that last year, I think, with Gerald Green, Sean Williams, guys like that. And, you know, someone will probably give him a shot because he's just got so much talent. But, you know, if you've got the question marks about you, like character or things like your attitude or you don't play defense, this is not the time. You know, that's going to hurt you more than ever when there's a situation where there's more guys than there are spots available.
I love it. One unintended impact of the recession is that people have to play defense now. Boy, basketball fans should be cheering the recession. Yo, check it, one for Charlie Hustle, two for Steady Rock, three for the fourth coming live, future shot. It's five dimensions, six senses, seven from immense of heaven to hell, 8 million stories to tell, nine planets faithfully keep in orbit with the probable tenth, the universe expands length, the body of my text possess extra strength, power lifted powerless, up out of this towering inferno, my ink so hot it burned through the journal, I'm blacker than midnight on Broadway and Myrtle, hip hop past all your tall social hurdles like the nationwide projects, prison industry complex, working class poor, better keep your alarm set, streets too loud to ever hear freedom ring, say it back in with your sleep, it's dangerous to dream, but your chin cats get they chip, you dead now, killing fields need blood to graze the cash cow, it's a numbers game but shit don't add up somehow. Alright, yeah, so as you mentioned during our first segment, you are working on some projections for Basketball Perspectives, and you just sent me over the Blazers list, and it's pretty ridiculous. I mean, you got it down to minutes per game, you've got projections on how many games guys will play, their projected three-point percentage, rebound percentage, true shooting percentage. I mean, you've really gone all out here. And Do you kind of feel like a puppet master of sorts? Like, do you feel like you've set these players' destinies where if you only say, hey, Steve Blake, you're only going to play 74 games next year? I mean, are you responsible for twisting his ankle? Or how do these projections work? And where do you come up with these numbers? What formulas do you look at? Is it only their past history? Or do you have some sort of, future telling ability that you haven't told me about?
Yeah, I have a magic eight ball that I actually shake, and I say, how many will Steve Blake play more than 75 games next year? Results, cloudy. I guess I'm going to have to shake again. And for the record, I take credit whenever the projection is good and it comes true. Whenever the projection is bad and that comes true, I want to be completely unaffiliated with it. It's just what the computer spits out. I had nothing to do with it. I'm just repeating what the computer says.
Well, can you give me an idea? What do you guys bat? I mean, how accurate are these before we, start saying that this is a gospel and everyone should believe everything you say? How close do you guys generally get? I mean, if you look back at last year, did you nail the Blazers pretty well? Was there anyone that was a huge surprise?
Well, I mean, I think our projection got the Blazers closer than almost any statistical projection that I saw. And quite frankly, a little bit of it was just luck. John Hollinger has a similar method that maybe is not quite as comprehensive in how it projects at the team level, but he was a little more pessimistic about the Blazers' chances. And part of the reason for that is that he has always used 3 years of player statistics to project individual players, whereas I was only using 1 year. So the fact that guys like Blake and Prisbilla had come off weak 2006-07 seasons and been much better in 2007-08 for the Blazers, which I know a lot of fans question when Hollinger said that they would probably revert backwards a little bit the next year. You know, that wasn't factored into my system, but was factored into his. And lo and behold, as it was, they actually ended up even playing better in 2008-09 than they did the year before. So my projection looked a lot better for them. I also had more positive projections, I think, for Rudy Fernandez and Greg Oden and the rookies because of the fact that I do that a little bit differently. But, adding this year we have gone to 3 years of data for players for the projections, which has improved the accuracy quite a bit. You know, I went back and sort of retrodicted the 2008-09 season, tried to project it as if we didn't know anything about what actually happened. And, the correlation between what we projected for each player in terms of a permanent ranking and what they actually did jumped way up when you used 3 years of data. But nothing is ever going to be completely accurate. And, this is based on Baseball Prospectus's PECOTA method, which Nate Silver, who's now more famous for projecting the election results and doing that at his site 538.com, but he's always been very good about saying that it's not about, we show a single projection, but it's more about telling you that there's a range, and this is kind of just the average of it, because there's so much that goes into what a player actually does in terms of health and luck and things like that.
So let's look at a couple of the guys that you projected for the Blazers, and I think that they may surprise some people each direction. So for this coming season, which would be Nick Batum's second year, you said that you had predicted him pretty well last year, is that right, as a rookie, or is it Rudy that you just said that?
I had him projected better than Hollinger did, but I didn't have him projected nearly as well as he ultimately played.
And part of that, I'm guessing, was because no one really anticipated Martell being out the whole season. But so he had a lot more minutes than probably anyone could have projected or any computer could have projected, unless computers were responsible for Martell's injury, in which case probably a whole different situation. But anyway, Nick Batum, what's he looking like for next year? Obviously, we've heard reports already this summer that he's looking fantastic in his play for Team France. He's still really young, so obviously he has a lot that he can develop in terms of his shooting abilities, in terms of just his size and strength. His quickness is already great for a three. What does your system say we should expect from Nick Batum next season? And first of all, how many minutes will he play? Because I think it's still an open question. Is he going to start? Is he going to come off the bench with Martell coming back? What says your computer?
Well, let me say that minutes per game is the one completely subjective part of this whole thing. So games played is actually projected based on how many games players have missed in previous seasons. So, for example, you know, Greg is projected to play only 68 games as opposed to, you know, the baseline is 76. If you didn't miss any of the last couple of years, which Andre Miller, who I just happened to look at, has played a full 82 each of the last 2 years, so he's projected to 76 because just kind of random luck, everybody is going to miss some games. But then Greg gets several knocked off for his injuries. But the minutes per game is just me looking at kind of depth charts and offering my best guess as to what I think guys are going to play. And, you know, with the Blazers, it was extremely difficult at that small forward position to figure out how that's going to shake out between Batum and Martell Webster, and the fact that Rudy's going to have to play minutes there. And then even Travis Outlaw playing a few minutes there. I'm going to see him probably more at power forward than small forward, but he's in that mix as well. So I have Batum playing 18 minutes a night, which is a little bit lower than he averages as a rookie. I think that, you know, he'll certainly be a better, more valuable contributor, and the numbers back that up. But just because of the minutes crunch with Webster's return, I think he might not play quite as much next year.
That makes sense. And I think the one number that really jumps off the page I'm looking at right now is going to be his three-point shooting percentage. Last year he was just under 39, kind of had a – I guess the shot came on a little bit, especially towards the second half of the year. The first half of the year, he seemed a little bit tentative. Didn't always want to pull the trigger when he had the open shot. He hit it out in the corner a lot, but a lot of times he just kind of, you know, ended up swinging the ball back over to Brandon or Steve because he wasn't quite ready to shoot it. Next year, you've actually got him projected to shoot almost 44% for the three-point. What caused that exactly? Can you explain that, or is this just the computer working, or where did you get that number from?
You know, guys who shoot so many threes, and they were nearly 40% of his shot attempts last year, and shoot them at least a decent percentage are pretty rare at the kind of age that Batum did it. So, you know, we talked about his comparable players when I wrote about Batum for Oregon Live and then their series this past spring, and, you know, there's a very impressive group of comparisons, but it's a lot of them guys who ended up becoming very good shooters. So Martell is on the list, you know, as one of his top comparables. Rashard Lewis is his number one most similar player, although fairly low similarity overall. And Joe Johnson is also on that list. And then Gerald Green has not really panned out as a shooter. So he's the oddball. But yeah, the expectation is guys that young who demonstrate even a little ability to shoot the ball from distance are going to improve fairly quickly. And I was surprised by how good that projection was, up over 40%. If he's shooting from 3-point range like that, it's going to be hard to keep him off the floor.
Yeah, I mean, he's going to see big-time minutes if he's shooting that high because of his defense and everything else he brings to the table, his hustle, his overall swag, his ability to just be crazy because he is a little bit crazy. He's a silent killer, too. Last week we talked about Brandon being a silent killer. Nick could be an assassin. I mean, he's the kind of guy who would be able to probably, you know, shoot someone in the head and walk away without flinching. Wouldn't you agree? I mean, he's got a little bit of that to him, which is unusual for a French player. I don't know if I've really ever seen Nick smile. I mean, I guess I have seen him smile, but he's kind of a stone-cold guy. All right, anyway, back to your projection. So we got Steve Blake here, and this is the year you think Steve Blake's going to fall off. Even though it's his contract year, he's playing for his future. He loves living in West Lynn. His family's here. Kevin Pritchard loves him. Nate McMillan wants to start him, but this is the year that he falls off, according to your projection system.
Well, yeah, again, you know, the fact that we're using 3 years' worth of data. The 2006-07 season was kind of ugly for Blake when he was in Denver, and he only shot 32% from three-point range that season. He's been up over 40% the last 2 years in Portland, and we still have him shooting over 40% from three, but just his numbers dropping off, you know, especially from last year, which is a career year for Steve. So you see a little bit of decline in several areas, and that just kind of adds up to a big difference. Although one of the interesting things is I decided yesterday, just for the fun of it, right now I've got Blake and Andre Miller to both projected to play 25 minutes a game, which is just like my way of copying out of that decision completely of who's going to start and how are the minutes going to shake out at the point. But I decided to play around with Miller playing 30 minutes a night and Blake only playing 20 minutes a night. And even though Andre Miller has the better individual projection, just because of the way they kind of fit into the offense and the fact that there's not a huge difference between them, you know, it only made a difference of 0.3 wins to the bottom line total. So you'd have to play Andre about 48 minutes a night and Blake about none for it to make even a difference of a single game. So
The 15 articles I'm going to write over the next month about how Nate's an idiot for starting Blake over Miller are completely statistically invalid. Is that what you're trying to tell me right now?
Much ado about nothing, but that shouldn't stop you from writing them. You know, I don't want to stand in your way on that one.
Hey, one other really interesting projection I noted is that Greg Oden, you projected to shoot 0% from the 3-point line again this year. You really cover every base here. This is great. No,
let me see if I can come up with the actual projection on like how many threes he's projected to attempt. He's not projected to attempt a single three next season. Joel Prisbella projected to go 0-for-1. So, you know, a 75-foot half-court heave we're seeing from Prisbella at some point this season. I feel funny, can't tell me nothing different. My nose twitching, intuition setting in like Steve Vision. I still close my eyes, I still see visions. Still hear that voice in the back of my mind. So what I do, I still take heed, I still listen. I still paint that perfect picture. I still shine bright like a prism. My words still skipping. I know you can't, don't, won't get it. You niggas chose to ride that ship, salt with it. I'm still afloat. I ain't the captain of the yacht, but I'm on a boat. I ain't acting what I'm not, knowing that I don't. You niggas acting like you will, but I know you won't. You won't, man. I read between the lines of the eyes of your brows. Your handshake ain't matching your smile. You niggas fine.
All right, last segment before we get to the Clyde Drexler interview, which you've been waiting your entire life for, or, you know, 20 minutes for, whatever. The big topic this week, because there's literally nothing going on with the Blazers, I think has been expectations for next season. And that's been fueled in part by Clyde, who said, or he told us in the interview you're about to listen to, that he sees the Blazers as the number one threat to the Lakers in the Western Conference. So he sees, you know, the Blazers, you know, sort of by default winning their division and potentially going to the Western Conference Finals, which would be a significant, you know, step up over last season's first round and out loss to the Houston Rockets. Also, Hollinger, who has notoriously loved the Blazers through all of his computer models in the past, sees the Blazers as one of the top three threats to the Lakers. What did your projection system say about the Blazers in terms of where they're going to rank in the Western Conference? I understand, obviously, a lot of people without access to computers or the same access to computers that you have. I love how I make you out to be like this like really creepy computerized person when in reality you're a pretty normal guy, but sorry about that. But a lot of people see the San Antonio Spurs as being a top three team. Other people like what Dallas has done. Other people see the Nuggets, obviously, who went to the Western Conference Finals. Some people see the Jazz as a bounce-back team from last season because they dealt with a lot of injuries. Where do you see the Blazers in that group?
One big takeaway from what I've done as far as projections so far is that the West is probably going to be similar to what it was a couple of years ago, where there's going to be, you know, 5, 6, maybe even 7 teams that win 50 games and are all bunched together and are very close in terms of talent and in the standings. You know, you've got the teams that have made moves this offseason, San Antonio, Dallas, that have been productive. You've got New Orleans and Utah, who are teams that are probably going to bounce back a little bit from what they did last year. That's just kind of natural when a team underachieves relative to expectations, they're going to be better the next year. One of the things that New Orleans faced last year that's going to be interesting for the Blazers is what's known as the plexiglass principle. Let me get that out. Plexiglass, which is where a team that makes a big improvement from one year to the next tends to give back a little bit of that the next year. And I mean, the Blazers weren't huge in terms of wins because it was 13, 41 to 54. But in terms of where that takes you in the conference, that's a pretty seismic leap from being out of the playoffs to having home court advantage the next. So if it were an average team, I think we'd expect the Blazers to come back to the pack fairly significantly, like the Hornets did last year. But the fact that the Blazers are such a young team And they didn't have tremendous luck in terms of injuries last year. That's often part of it. But, you know, Martell was out the entire year. Greg missed a lot of time. Blake missed some time. So I think that and the addition of Andre Miller, those are kind of working against each other. But I think if people are getting huge expectations in terms of wins and thinking 60 wins, you know, I'm not sure that's a good idea. But the fact is that the Blazers, and I think Barry articulated this point well, are going to be closer to the top of the conference than they were last year, that they're going to have a much more legitimate shot of actually potentially even winning the whole Western Conference. And I think that's the most exciting thing for Blazers fans next year.
Do you think that part of what's helping the Blazers work against that plexiglass principle that you call it is the fact that they are so deep? And do you think that's sort of part of what Kevin Pritchard has really tried to do in assembling this roster, is the idea that, you know, those, so that Hornets team wasn't necessarily the deepest team. I mean, I'm not sure exactly how many guys they went deep, but maybe 8 guys. And they're a lot more vulnerable to having a bad stretch, whereas the Blazers, you know, running 10, 11, 12 guys deep, assuming Brandon doesn't go down, God forbid, that would be awful. Jeez, I don't even want to think about that. But assuming he doesn't go down, they can pretty much, you know, flip along at any pace thanks to their depth and push back against that, the idea that they would, you know, fall off or fall back to earth, wouldn't you think?
No, I think that's a good point. And with the Hornets, we saw it specifically with Tyson Chandler. You know, he was banged up much of the year. He wasn't quite himself for whatever reason, whether it was injuries or whether it was something else. And, you know, that meant starting Hilton Armstrong and playing Sean Marks rotation minutes. I mean, the one game the Hornets won in the playoffs, Sean Marks was the catalyst off the bench. That's pretty remarkable, and part of why I think they're going to be better next year, because of the fact that they added Ike Diaga to give them a little more depth up front, in addition to, you know, trading Chandler for Emeka Okafor, which I think helps them a little bit. But, yeah, if you see somebody go down at the small forward position, God forbid, there's 3 more guys there who can step in. And it's true of most positions. You know, if it's one of the point guards, then the other one can capably step up and play 32, 35 minutes a night, you know, Jared Bayless stepping in as backup. So I think the Blazers are awfully well insulated against that.
Well, it's fitting that you mentioned Ike Diagu on the day that Madden is released, because we know he was there probably till midnight. He's probably still there playing on, like, the store demo console, hasn't even shaved, showered, anything. He's probably been there for like 14 hours straight now playing. That guy is just addicted to video games. It's too bad he doesn't care about the NBA as much as he does video games. He actually could be a player. You know, you make a good point. It doesn't really matter 60 wins or not. That's not really the question, right? But the important question, I think, is, okay, are the Blazers the favorites to win the Northwest Division? I think they're deeper, and we can agree that they're deeper than both the Nuggets and the Jazz. But there's things to like about both the Nuggets and the Jazz, you know, in terms of obviously Jazz, great point guard, better than either one of the point guards the Blazers have. Great team leader, great system, arguably a better system than Nate runs. The Nuggets, more experience. You know, you've got another great point guard, again, better than either point guard the Blazers have, but also a big-time scorer at that three who has the respect of everyone around the league, gets tons of calls, can really fill it up, and has proven to be relatively clutch. I thought this last playoffs, you know, Carmelo looked pretty good. Do you see the Blazers as the early favorites for the Northwest Division Championship? Regardless of how many wins they get, do you think that they should be ranked ahead of both Utah and Denver?
Yeah, right now I would have them as the slight favorites in the Northwest. Denver is really one of those interesting teams to me this year, because they're not going to have that depth we talked about. You know, they're right now sitting at 10 players, I believe, and they'll probably re-sign Chucky Atkins. That'll give them 11, and they have a couple more roster spots to fill out, but they don't have any money, basically, with which to do it. You know, they saved some money with the Stephen Hunter trade, and then with Linus Klaza going over to Europe and not taking their qualifying offer, but now they need to fill Klaza's spot. So, you know, it's a question of, and one of those 10 guys right now, or a couple of them, are Malik Allen and Aaron Aflalo, who they're hoping can kind of fill Dante Jones' role from last year, but never did much in Detroit. Although then again, Dante Jones had never done much of anything before he got to the Nuggets. So, you know, their top 5, 6, 7 guys are probably as good as anybody's in the NBA. You know, if you look at their starting lineup, and then assuming J.R. Smith is now part of that starting lineup, then Chris Anderson, and, you know, I'm a huge Ty Lawson fan, as I think we talked about leading up to the draft. So I think he's going to help them a lot, upgrade them a lot there. But once you get past that group, and maybe even Ronaldo Volkman, another guy with good numbers, then there's just not a lot there. So if they start having some injuries, and they had pretty good luck with health last year, then Denver's a team that you could see really, really get hit by injuries. Utah, you know, I just have a hard time seeing them getting to the level of those other two teams right now. They got to sort out this Boozer and Millsap situation. The two of them don't play tremendously well together because it's a lack of size in the front court, but that's going to be, you know, their lineup a lot of the time. They've still got question marks on the wings in terms of, you know, they played C.J. Miles a lot of minutes last year. He's not very good. Kyle Korver went through a rough season. So, you know, I mean, it's certainly close enough that I wouldn't be surprised if Utah were to end up winning the Northwest Division, but I have them a little bit a notch below, I think, Denver and Portland right now.
Well, wonderful. It's good to hear that you say the Blazers are the slight favorites to win the Northwest Division. That's a great segue right into Clyde Drexler, Blazers legend, about to tell us that not only are they the slight favorites, they're the overwhelming favorites. Some other topics that I touch on with Clyde, we talk a little bit about his Olympic experience in 92. He actually thinks the 92 team, if they played the 2008 team, would have no problem. He says five games, and only because they might get tired and try to sleep them. That was his declaration. So that's coming up. He also talks about the Andre Miller acquisition. Unlike you, he's not an Andre Miller hater for the Blazers. But keep in mind, this interview was recorded at 3:45 a.m. in the morning. So if I sound a little bit tired and groggy, and Clyde sounds a little bit out of it, that's why. The first interview, he said, in a long day of interviews, building up to the fact that he was inducted into the United States Olympics Hall of Fame.
I'm the magnificent with the sensational style. Far from being shallow, cause she caught me with a smile. Try to figure out my style. Maybe that'd take a minute, but if all we got is time. You can't be acting timid, so we back to playing tennis. Meaning going back and forth. She the one that I adore, so I try to enter raw. Conscious in the veins, concentrating on my cream. I'm the king, make a move, pawns all the way to queens. I'm a don, I'm a boss, I'm a prophet, I'm a G. I'm a CEO, which means that I profit off of me. Yeah. All white tees, they're rocking my neck ass. Fresh out of flight school, cause I'm fly right here. Yeah. Ain't nothing free, I'm charging the breed bag. If it's not on Maybach, really, who the hell cares? My money long, my nigga, my money strong. If you ain't getting money, that mean you done something wrong.
I'm doing well. How are you doing?
I'm doing really well. Can't believe you're up this time of morning.
Well, hey, you know, I'll get up at any time to talk to you. You know that, 24 hours a day. Well, I understand you're in Chicago this week, obviously getting inducted into the United States Olympic Hall of Fame presented by Allstate. That must be a huge honor for you.
So it's an honor to be here because all of the people involved have put in so much work to make this weekend so special. And, you know, we were able to go on and win a gold medal. Dream Team won, which is the original, the best, the only. I'm not biased.
Hey, was that gold medal the single greatest accomplishment or greatest honor that you earned in your basketball career, or is there anything else that compared to it?
I just think it was another great honor, and I had a lot of wonderful accomplishments in the game of basketball. And, of course, to win a gold medal for your country, it doesn't get any better than that.
You know, that team, like you said, was the original. It was sort of the first dream team. You know, people look at that team as sort of really being an instigator and improving the quality of play all across the world. Do people still come up to you and say, hey, you know, I remember seeing you, you know, maybe little kids or guys who are in their 20s now and say, I remember watching that team, and that was the reason why I really got into basketball? Or what role do you see the original dream team having played in developing basketball globally?
Well, I think it woke up the world and just letting them know how big a gap there was in the skill level in terms of basketball in this country and basketball played in other places. And so there's been a lot of development because of that in the last 17 years in other countries to develop the programs of basketball. And the youngsters are playing a lot more basketball than they did in the 90s. And so it's been a wonderful thing to see. And that's evidenced by having more international players compete in NBA. I think we have over 70, 80 international players playing in our league today.
Hey, you know, the 2008 Olympic team obviously got a real challenge from Spain, and you know, all through the entire process. Were you guys ever truly challenged on that 92 team? Were you ever concerned at all, or were you pretty confident entering every single game? Hey, we've got this.
Well, we were concerned that we wanted to come out and compete, and not only did we want to compete, we wanted to beat them by a sizable margin and just play the way we're capable of. That was our concern, not to have any letdowns. You know, that team was coached by Chuck Daly, Mike Krzyzewski, Lenny Wilkins, and P.J. Carlissimo. So we had some great coaches. We had guys who were leaders, all-stars on the floor. So we pretty much knew what we had to do.
Was there a pretty high stress level, though, even given all that? I mean, did you really feel the pressure of, you know, the entire country on your back, maybe?
Not at all, because we were having too much fun.
Okay.
And it was kind of like we knew we were a lot better than most of the teams. It was just a question of going out and executing.
Absolutely. Hey, you know, a lot of the guys that came back from Beijing, whether it's LeBron or Kobe, they said that time they spent together, maybe not even during the games, but the time behind the scenes was really a huge motivator for them coming into this past season. You know, they really got up for the games against each other, you know, when they would see each other over the course of the year. Did you have a similar experience when you got back from your time in the Olympics, whether you saw Michael Jordan or whoever else it might have been? Was there a certain added importance to those games that next season?
Well, the thing is, back then, there were some real rivalries. So we really didn't like guys on the other team. Literally, when you were on the court, it was all business. And it wasn't that friendly. I mean, because some of the guys, I mean, you had some real serious battles with. And so when you're on the same team with these guys, it kind of changed things and how we viewed the game. And so it was a wonderful occurrence. Like some of the guys in the Eastern Conference, like I had never been on their teams. Like Larry Bird, even though you make the All-Star team, you're going to be on the West. He's on the East. So you're never going to be teammates. And so that gave us an opportunity to kind of be teammates and work for the same common goal.
Were guys still kind of keeping
it? When you saw them the next year, you're still trying to get 50 on them. Beat them up. But at least it was a lot more fun because you had a personal relationship with them.
You know, there's four Blazers currently in the development program, you know, various stages. Obviously, Brandon Roy, LaMarcus Aldridge, Greg Oden, and Jared Bayless. Of those four guys, can you see any of them or maybe multiple of those guys making or eventually making it an Olympic team, a senior men's national team?
Every one of those guys can potentially make it. Are you kidding? Every one of those guys are immensely talented and going to have long and fruitful NBA careers. All they got to do is stay healthy.
I'm assuming you did see Rudy's gold medal performance in Beijing. I was just hoping to get your thoughts on that.
Rudy played really well for Spain, and you got to give him a lot of credit. This is a guy who's come into the league. It's a new experience for him. He had a great rookie year. I think he's going to build on that and get a little bit more confidence and perhaps get a little bit more strength. He's got to get in the weight room, but he's got a lot of talent. He's got a bright future.
Hey, the big move the Blazers made this summer was adding Andre Miller to the backcourt. I guess the big concern that people have had here in Portland is how well will he play with Brandon? Can they both play? You know, supposedly they need the ball in their hands. Is that a valid criticism? I mean, do you think, you know, it's really that impossible to have two guys who, quote-unquote, need the ball to play on the same team?
Well, the one thing you got to know is there's two guys that may need the ball, but there's one guy who's going to have it when it counts. and that'll be Brandon Roy. I think Andre Miller is a seasoned veteran. Great acquisition. I think he understands that he's just coming in to help facilitate. He's not trying to run the show. And so he's gonna give Brandon Roy all of the chances he needs to kind of lead that team.
Hey, you know, one other topic that we've been kind of debating around Portland for the past week or so, sort of in light of Brandon's contract extension, were the elements that he could potentially add to his game. So people have talked about maybe improving his defensive intensity, adding a transition game. You know, Brandon even said he'd like to improve his mid-range game. When you look at Brandon's game, what aspects of his game do you think need the most improvement? Obviously, he's a complete player, but where do you see room for improvement in Brandon's game?
Well, first of all, Brandon's already pretty polished. He's darn good. He's He's a hard worker. And even though he's that good, I think every year you have to continue to work on a different facet of your game to improve it. And I never stopped trying to improve. After 15 years of playing, I was still trying to think of something that I could do better throughout the course of the year. So that's a continuing evolution. You never stop improving. And Brandon is smart enough to understand that. That's the reason he's as good as he is right now, because he knows he needs to perform at a very high level. And the only way to do that is to keep improving your skills. And well, so you got to give him a lot of credit.
What were some of the things that you added to your game in the second half of your career?
Well, some of the things I added to my game were after that Olympic team, you know, you watch what other players do well and you try to emulate or incorporate that into your game. And so it makes you a better player when you're around better competition. And if you pay attention, you can learn something.
looking forward to next season, I think people still see the Lakers as probably the favorites in the Western Conference. Who else do you think is going to give them a real run for their money?
Obviously, the Blazers are first and foremost on my list. I think the Rockets, with the injury to Yao Ming, they're going to be good, but they're not going to be, unless some of the younger players really step up, they may not be the top three teams in the West. But you look at some of the other teams that are going to be back. San Antonio, if Duncan stays healthy, could compete for the title. Other than that, that's my top three. Dallas, I don't think, got any better. You know, New Orleans, it depends on their chemistry with the new center. They could be there. Chris Paul is special. That's about it. I don't see any other teams doing much with the Lakers.
Well, I pretty much agree with your analysis, spot on as always. I really appreciate you taking the time to talk with us, and congratulations on the honor, and good luck today.
Well, we're going to have a great time in Chicago, and one of the reasons this event is so special is because the Allstate kind of resurrected the USOC's Hall of Fame initiatives, and so this is the culmination of what this whole weekend, of all the hard work that they put in to make this a special weekend. And since Chicago's trying to host the 2016 Summer Games, what a great city to have the induction ceremony in.
Absolutely. Is the entire team back?
Most of the team is back now. Not all of them. Most of the team. Do you remember the guys on that team?
Well, I'm pretty much all of them. I remember, you know, the one name that always surprised people was Christian Laettner, but obviously Jordan, Magic, Larry, I mean, the list goes on.
Yeah, Malone, David Robinson, Patrick Ewing, Scotty, Stockton. Pretty good team.
Hey, if you guys played the 2008 team in a series of seven, how long would it take you to beat them?
Four. Well, let's give them a little credit. Maybe five.
Could anybody give you more than a five-game series? Any team that you've seen?
The 96 team was pretty good. That team included Shaq and Olajuwon. they were pretty good.
So you guys first, then 96, then 2008?
Yeah, that's about right.
All right. Well, very good. Congratulations.
That would be the pecking order, I believe.
Well, as long as you guys are always on top, right?
And I'm not biased at all.
All righty. Well, good luck. Congratulations again, and best of luck this weekend.
Oh, thank you. It should be a magnificent weekend. It's a wonderful honor, and I'm delighted to be here.
All righty. Take care, Clyde.
So in that, I became more curious. Fuck being up north, delirious, more serious. So killer did mixtapes. CEOs heard, now here come Big Cake. But one cat said, Cam, you better recoup. For you back on your block, baby, dead on your stoop. But unhook me up with all this cheddar and loot. The best rap deal of all time, next to Snoop. Money more to clutch, money more to touch. I don't just rhyme, my own liquor stores and such. But yeah, yo, the rap game remind me of the crack game. Niggas wanna get their gun, then start the clap game. For that fame, grow entertainment. Sports, drugs, entertainment. To the reigning killer.